Sexual harassment training is required by law for all California agency supervisors, but dozens of state employers did not offer it last year, and that's illegal. On Insight, the investigation by Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd. He looked at the number of agencies that were not in compliance and why. Then the doctored video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The PolitiFact California team has analyzed the video and issues around it. I'll talk about that with reporter Chris Nichols. Plus, he introduces a new rating called the flip-flop. Later in the hour, Sac State Professor Emeritus Andania Kokouras. She is restaging her one-woman show, Unveiling the Soul. It's a special one-night performance June 15th. We'll talk about the show and more. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's all coming up today on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Robert Mueller spoke publicly this morning. He announced that he's closing the special counsel's office and resigning, that the office's work is done, and that the words of his report should speak for themselves. He said he does not want to testify before Congress, and he said the circumstances needed to be investigated. His quote was, "If we'd had confidence the president didn't commit a crime, we would have said so." You can find ongoing coverage throughout the day, both on the air and at capradio.org. Now we're going to move to an investigation focused on sexual harassment training within California state agencies. Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd has published his compilation of the numbers in these agencies that are in non-compliance, and more than half of the agencies fall into that category from last year. Scott joins me now in the studio. Hi, glad to have you here.
Good morning, Beth.
I want to start by establishing a few basics. Who exactly are we talking about that's required to have this basic sexual harassment training?
So state law requires that private employers with more than 50 employees and all state agencies provide sexual harassment training to supervisors. For new hires or promoted supervisors, they need to receive this training within 6 months. And then on an ongoing basis, every 2 years, the supervisors need to receive an updated sort of recurring training.
It's not optional, correct? This is the law.
According to the law, it is not optional. No, this training needs to be provided.
I think it's important to add some backdrop to all of this, and that takes us back to 2017 in the midst of the national Me Too movement, and that's when the We Said Enough campaign began. And the goal of that campaign was...
Well, it was to draw attention to the issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault in some cases in state government. Over 140 women signed an open letter calling out the issue of sexual harassment, specifically in state the state legislature. But it went beyond that as well. They said there is a toxic culture in state government that allows this to persist, that sees this happening and that turns a blind eye towards it. And it was pretty remarkable to see this many people, this many women signing on to this letter, but also the women who signed on to it were very influential women who were calling this out, and they called it out in very stark terms.
So their ongoing goals include changing laws and changing policy. And here we are with a look back at 2018. And there were agencies that were, and many that were not, following through on this basic requirement of the law in terms of sexual harassment training. How many didn't meet the requirement?
So last year, it was more than half of the agencies surveyed. They surveyed 17 agencies. 9 of them were out of compliance. The previous year, it was around 30% that didn't comply. And then the previous year was about a quarter. So in total, it was dozens. It was in the dozens of in recent years that have not provided this sexual harassment training.
Let's go into some of the specifics. Let's look at which ones and how many supervisors were not trained.
Sure. The big one that jumps out is the Department of Corrections. They failed to train nearly 700 supervisors. It's worth noting that they're also one of the larger agencies that the State Personnel Board surveys. They have about 8,000 plus supervisors. So it's a very large department, mm-hmm. but again, a very large number of supervisors who were not provided training. The Department of Healthcare Services, they were surveyed just this year in the upcoming report that'll be out later this year, that's under progress right now, but they failed to train 230 supervisors out of about 720. The Department of State Hospitals, they failed to train 150 out of about 870. So those were some of the ones with the highest numbers of supervisors that were untrained. But there were some smaller agencies, too, that failed to train a couple dozen. And some failed to train all of their supervisors. And those were usually the ones that are a little on the smaller side, though.
What are some of the reasons given to you about why the noncompliance was happening?
So I was able to determine this through requesting the corrective action plans that these agencies need to submit to the State Personnel Board. Each one that's not in compliance has to submit a plan to say, okay, how are we going to improve this? And it's my understanding they're not required to say what caused the noncompliance, but some of them do offer that. And what I could see is for a number of them, it was a failure to track this training. Hmm. Some simply just didn't have a tracking mechanism in place to see who was being trained, who still needed to be trained, and whether or not they were up to compliance. Some also had pretty lax tracking methods. The Department of Industrial Relations, for example, they said that they tracked their training on an Excel spreadsheet and manually updated it. That's not exactly the most sophisticated way to track something like supervisor training. And then there were also issues with personnel. One department said the individual who oversaw training and compliance, that role had not been filled for several years. And so training just started to slip through the cracks. Mm. So I saw a range of different reasons. I think the one that that was most clear, though, was a failure to track or just very lax tracking methods.
Who's reacting with surprise to this? Scott, what kind of feedback are you getting on these results?
I'm getting a mixture of both surprise, but also sort of disappointment, but not that surprised, if that makes sense. For example, Samantha Corman, who's one of the co-founders of We Said Enough,
right.
She's also a fairly high-profile consultant in town. When I presented the findings to her, when I interviewed her for the story, she said, you know, this both surprises me and it doesn't, because she has seen this so much in state government. I think what surprised her was that she hadn't seen this before, that this didn't come to light when a lot of the Me Too revelations were kind of reaching a fever pitch last year. Mm. This is something that hasn't been discussed as much. And in the story, I talk about how in the legislature, this became kind of a the legislature was a lightning rod for this issue. But not as much was discussed on the regulatory side or on the agency side of state government. So I think that's where people are surprised. I think they believed that a lot of this had been aired out. A lot of this had been discussed. But the reality is a lot of the discussion happened on the legislature side. Not as much was happening on what's going on over at the regulatory agencies.
I'm talking with Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd, and I want to get to what can happen as a result of supervisors not receiving the appropriate training.
One of the clearest things is creating an unsafe work environment. I spoke with Suzanne Ambrose. She's the head of the State Personnel Board. And she had this to say about what can result from lack of training.
Supervisors who aren't aware of those requirements or don't know how to identify sexual harassment aren't, you know, we can assume they're not in there proactively addressing it.
So what you're hearing there is the State Personnel Board head saying, if you don't receive training, a supervisor really is the first line of defense. You know, they are the ones who are in there observing who is facing this harassment. They're in there identifying it or should be identifying it. So if someone doesn't receive this training, that's crucial for them to be able to identify those things. And beyond that, if sexual harassment is occurring in the workplace, one of the things I heard repeatedly was there's a risk of legal liability. Hmm. If someone brings a lawsuit, if someone brings a claim against a state agency, that can result in very high cost payouts or settlements. So without this training in place, this, you know, 2-hour training, you know, once every 2 years, that can result in some very costly legal ramifications as well.
The question is, who's in charge of enforcing this law? I've been in workplaces where the HR administrator will be the one to make sure you know that you have a certain training module to complete and that the tracking is done sometimes digitally in a way, if it's an online course, for example. I imagine the tracking happens differently agency to agency, but overall, what is the oversight?
So there are kind of multiple levels, multiple layers of oversight. And when there's that kind of structure, sometimes it means that it's really ironclad. Sometimes it means that things start to slip through the cracks. In this situation, I would say it's more the latter. The agencies themselves are responsible for tracking the training. Obviously, that's been somewhat of an issue, but a number of them have said that they've adopted a more sophisticated tracking system. But beyond the agencies, the State Personnel Board provides these audits every year, but they don't have an enforcement mechanism. They don't have, they're not a policing body. They identify these issues and then they leave it up to the agencies to fix it. And the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, they are the ones in the letter of the law who are tasked with enforcing this, with actually making sure that the agencies comply. But the director of the department told me they don't have an adequate way to essentially compel agencies to follow this law. They have the ability to issue violation orders, but he said that they've never issued a violation order against a state agency for failing to comply. And that's not because clearly everyone's in compliance. That's not the case. What he said was that they have a very difficult time determining who is not compliant. And he said it usually rises to their attention only after someone files a sexual harassment complaint, which seems backwards, right? The sexual harassment training is meant to deter and stop sexual harassment from occurring in the first place. But it only becomes clear for the Department of Fair Employment and Housing that someone isn't providing this training until someone claims they're sexually harassed.
It could also point to another point that I know people make in this is whether the training really works. There are a lot of people who might say, great, it's good we have it. Others who say, it doesn't make a difference. So we're just going through a rote motion here.
And there were several people who brought that up in my conversations as well. Actually, that department director, the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, he said, you know, the training in concept is very important, but he said in practice, what's being provided, he said it's not very adequate. He says it needs to be improved, which I think is a fair point. I think many people would say that's not a reason to abandon it completely. That's a reason to improve it. And in that director, actually, they're producing training materials right now. And he said, I'm happy that we're doing this because we have a little more control over the effectiveness of these training materials.
You did talk to an assemblywoman who has been working on this concept for a long, long time. And in fact, I think she's still taking legislative action to try to enforce compliance.
Well, So she was the legislator who introduced the law back in 2004. It went into effect in 2006. So it's been on the books for a very long time. I think it's worth noting that this law predates the Me Too movement. This former legislator, she actually termed out, but it's still very much something that she is concerned about. And that came through in my conversation with her. She had said to me that she wants to see the legislature take action on this, that she doesn't want them to just sit back.
I would appeal to the legislature that they shine a light on this, that they audit these state agencies and they bring them before them and say, why have you been out of compliance?
Okay, there's that piece of thought, but then add where the governor is on all this.
So I spoke to, or rather I reached out to the governor's office on this, and I was somewhat surprised to hear their response simply because this hadn't come up in any of the conversations I had elsewhere. The governor's office said that this is something that the Newsom administration took notice of pretty much upon Newsom entering office, shortly after being sworn in, they noticed that there was lack of compliance at these agencies. And they said the administration directly reached out to agencies and said, you need to get into compliance. This isn't an option. And they told me that they expect near or full compliance by July. And again, this is it was news to me, and all the conversations I had had about sexual harassment training compliance, this had not come up. So it was very, it was interesting to hear this. And it's something that I'm starting to look at. I'm looking into further to see what exactly these actions are that are coming from the governor's office.
That definitely sets the stage for some follow-up reporting.
Absolutely.
This has been a powerful group of pieces. I will again tell everyone that your stories and more background on this issue of sexual harassment training and compliance in California government can be found at capradio.org. And I thank you for joining us today. I think even if you aren't hearing a lot of feedback, the fact that this kind of conversation is ongoing for the people that initially were bold and outspoken 2 years ago has to be satisfying.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's an important topic, and I think it's a reminder that while there's been a lot of discussion of this in the last year or two, it's still an important area for us to look at.
That is Scott Rodd, Cap Radio State Government Reporter, and you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Facebook says it will not remove the doctored viral video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It's still on Twitter, too. YouTube has said the video does violate its policy and has removed it. And you might have heard me talking about this video with the political junkie Ken Rudin yesterday. The PolitiFact California team has taken a closer look at it and some of the issues surrounding it. And reporter Chris Nichols joins me now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
This video is getting a lot of attention. Will you just go back to explaining what it is?
Sure. This is a manipulated video. It shows House Speaker Nancy Pelosi slurring her speech, speaking at a conference. And, you know, it spread rapidly across social media. I think it's gained something like close to 3 million views as of early this week. It was shared by President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and it's, you know, created quite a stir.
The original video, I believe, was from last Wednesday.
That's
right.
It was posted a week ago.
Do you know when the doctored video showed up, and do we know anything about who did it?
Well, it was posted a week ago by a Facebook page called Politics Watchdog. We don't know a whole lot about them. They describe themselves as a watchdog of both Democrats and Republicans, and they say that they like to poke fun at both parties. But other than that, there's not a whole lot of information about them. They essentially just post lots and lots of videos of politicians giving speeches on this Facebook page.
Maybe the best way to explain this is to do a little listening. So we're going to share a clip with you that, first of all, is what we'll call the regular speed of Nancy Pelosi speaking. So here goes.
We want to give this president the opportunity to do something historic for our country.
All right. Sounds like Nancy Pelosi. So here's how she sounded after the audio was tampered with.
We want to give this president the opportunity to do something historic for our country.
And you're only hearing the audio version, I think, also seeing the visual of her sort of moving in a weird pace adds to the distortion of it.
Right. But that second one is clearly slowed down. You know, it takes a couple extra seconds when you measure it. And the experts who've weighed in say that it was slowed down to about 75% of the original speed. They also noted that the voice was altered in that second one as well. It was sort of corrected in a way where whoever did the editing sort of went back and added a higher pitch, because otherwise you would have heard this very deep tone from Pelosi in the slowed down version. So there was, not a high amount of doctoring, but definitely some manipulation for that video.
You talked to a UC Berkeley computer science professor, and with what you just said, it strikes me that some of the doctoring was changing the video to make it close enough. Maybe that if you weren't paying a lot of attention, you might have had a glance or a quick listen, thought, oh, wow, that is her. What's going on?
That's right. I spoke with Hani Farid, and he's a UC Berkeley computer science professor, a digital forensics expert. He's looked at videos like this. He's written op-eds about them. He weighs in about the larger implications, both, I guess, the how to detect them, but also what kind of questions are raised by this? What kind of effect does this have on the general public when they see their politicians sort of distorted in their speech like this? And he told me that the problem is not really the videos themselves, but more the delivery mechanism, which is social media.
Just about anybody now can create a fake video, really simple low-tech ones like you saw with Speaker Pelosi and two more sophisticated deep fake types of videos. And they can distribute them to the tune of millions and millions of views. And the person in the middle, the YouTubes, the Facebooks, and the Twitters, are doing very little to actually deal with these misinformation campaigns.
So that was Professor Farid. And he, as you can hear there, he's been critical of these social media platforms. We should say that YouTube did take down the video.
Right.
Facebook decided not to. Facebook, essentially, to sort of paraphrase what they said they're not a news organization. They don't go by the same rules. They're a sharing platform. But I should say that what they have done is they've alerted people who use their site and go to this particular post that it has been fact-checked. So you see right underneath the post sort of a lineup of different organizations, including PolitiFact, which has a partnership with Facebook to go ahead and fact check posts that have been flagged by users. So you will see that if you try to share the post, a screen will pop up and it'll also list all of these fact checks and let you know that, you know, there's more information about this, but they have not taken it down.
Facebook is getting some criticism for not taking it down. At the same time, I know there are more than 2.5 million views, probably approaching 3 million by this time. At the point that you talked to the expert, the video was already viral, correct?
That's right. It was. And, it just continued to gain views over the weekend. And we have another clip from Professor Farid where he talks about, again, these social media platforms, what they should do. But I think he brings up an interesting point as well about what the general public can do.
The platforms have to think about their policies on what are they going to allow and what are they not going to allow. And then, of course, the public has to get more discerning. The fact is that these videos would also not get as much traction if people weren't so quick to comment and share and like and retweet. But everybody is so quick to believe the worst in the people that they disagree with that we've lost all sense of common sense.
Well, that is wishful thinking to think that if we wouldn't be so quick to comment, that's simply the age that we're living in right now, and can't help but think that we have a presidential campaign upon us and so many candidates, and that maybe this opened a different doorway or different window.
I think that's the concern. I think, you know, we have the 2020 election essentially underway, and this is not, again, this is not a really sophisticated manipulation. It looks like it. These are just minor changes, just slowing down the speed. And so I think that's part of the concern. If you can have these sort of low-tech fakes, as Professor Freed describes them, go viral and get millions and millions of views, what does that say about someone who puts together a more sophisticated video where you really can't tell whether it's real or not? And it's, who knows, the president or someone in a position of authority. So that's, I think, the concern. The professor does say, in addition to which I agree with you, Beth, you know, the calling for the general public to slow down. I don't know if that's going to happen, mm-hmm. but there is technology to try to slow some of these down. He talks in an op-ed about this photo DNA technology where you can essentially fingerprint content that's been removed, and then that makes it more difficult or blocks it from being reposted. So there are some ways, he argues, that social media platforms can be more active and use technology to prevent this.
I want to clarify something that you just said when you made reference to the president or someone in a position of authority, because Nancy Pelosi is in a very high position of authority. But I think you meant the use of video at a key moment regarding a policy or a vote or something. And this video of her was in a conversation. She did use some powerful words and accusations, but I don't think it was the kind of moment that you were talking about.
That's right. If, say, the president, a video makes him appear from inside the White House giving a speech about some military action or a moment in time where the public really needs to understand what's going on. So someone in addition to Pelosi at a more critical juncture. You're right.
The article is an analysis, and it's posted now.
That's right. It's posted at politifact.com/California, as well as on the capradio.org website. And it goes through all of the responses from the professor about this topic.
You're listening to Chris Nichols from the PolitiFact California team. We're going to shift topics and focus for a moment on California Senator Kamala Harris. She's running for president. Your team gave her a full flop rating recently, but that's a new rating. So explain this and why she earned it.
It is. It's a new rating or one that we have not used much, but we are fact-checking and watching Senator Harris very closely as she runs for the Democratic nomination for president. And PolitiFact has something it calls its flipometer. And so I'll explain a little bit about how this works. Really, it's just a way for PolitiFact to trace a politician's stance on a key issue through time, how they've changed on a topic or a position. And it has three ratings. They're pretty simple. First is no flip, so no significant change in a position. Half flip, a partial change in a position. And finally, the rating that we gave on this particular issue that we'll talk about, full flop. That's when a politician makes a complete change or reversal in a position. And I think there is one last important note about this. This rating does not make a value judgment about a politician who changes their mind on a position. We know that voters do sometimes appreciate politicians who are flexible and can adapt or evolve on a topic. But there are quite a few accusations out there in politics about shifting positions, so we find it's helpful to trace those through time.
Let's listen to what Senator Harris said last week on MSNBC. The issue here is police shootings and her position that the shooting should undergo independent investigations.
What's the best way to deal with police shootings and alleged police brutality? As you know, in the wake of many of these incidents, the view is by some that the independent probes are better, to not let the DA investigate the cops they work with daily. Have you changed your mind about that, or what is the best approach?
I believe the best approach is to have independent investigations. There's no question.
She said what she thinks the best approach is. She didn't answer the part where he asked her whether she's changed her mind.
That's right. She didn't explicitly respond to that part. But if you go back and look through time, which we did, at her responses in news articles, for example, back in 2014, she very clearly opposed taking this investigative authority away from local prosecutors. And remember, she was a local prosecutor. She was San Francisco's district attorney. So she had that power in that role. 2 years later, then Attorney General Kamala Harris declined to endorse a bill at the Capitol that would have required her office to appoint a special prosecutor to examine fatal shootings by police. And then more recently, last year, after the high-profile shooting of Stephon Clark here in Sacramento, she did not weigh in to call for any change in who investigates these shootings. So she certainly has had opportunities to talk about changes in the past. But this comment on MSNBC, as far as we could find, was the first public change in her stance.
So she gets the full flop. Is PolitiFact putting any kind of judgment on this in any way about that issue of a stance on something changing?
I think that people may take it that way. That's not the intention. I think it can spark a discussion about politicians and changing their stances, whether a politician changes it because it's to their advantage politically, or perhaps they have come across new information and it's a sort of a way to evolve on an issue. That's not really what we are saying. We are saying this is what was said in the past, and this is where she is now. And then the readers can make up their own minds.
Probably in the past, though, during campaigns, most recently in 2016, the phrase, you flip-flopped on that, sounded more like an accusation. So it carried with it a tone. But the fact is, we have a lot of changing social issues right now, and it isn't uncommon to have a candidate, especially someone who's been in public service or public office for a long time, change and shift.
Right. And I think the thing that's interesting to me is the explanation from the politician as to why they've changed. Has new information come about? Or is it just that, you know, the country has changed and the politics have changed? So I think, you know, figuring that out, and that's what something we try to offer is what was the context of the change in these articles.
So is this posted also right now
this
as a fact check?
This is also posted at politifact.com/California.
All right. Well, the debates are going to begin later in June and then into July. So there will be a lot to fact check. In the meantime, it's always a pleasure to have you on Insight, Chris.
Thank you, Beth.
That is PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. You can see much more about the California fact checking and the national fact checking at
PolitiFact.com.
And you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Theater professor emeritus Andania Kakouras has been busy. She announced her retirement from Sacramento State in 2014, and at the end of that year, in the spring of 2015, she performed with a large student cast the show Unveiling the Soul. She had written it, produced it, choreographed it, directed it, and Professor Kakouras has been performing it since. She's been back on campus many times as a guest artist, and she is again staging Unveiling the Soul as a one-woman show, one night only, June 15th at 8 o'clock. She joins me in the studio. It's great to have you back. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much, Beth. It's wonderful to be here.
If I remember correctly, this show was originally a tribute to your students as you were retiring.
Yes, it was. I was supposed to do a one-woman show that year. The department asked me to, but it didn't feel right, because for 38 years I taught there and the students were my life. So I asked to have students in it, and I had a fabulous 11-member chorus in it. And so that's what it was in 2015.
Over time, the show has changed. Has the meaning changed for you?
That's a wonderful question. I did the show only as a one-woman show last year at Delta College in Stockton. I was asked to do a solo showcase, so I had to adapt it. I had to change all of the staging, and this was on a large proscenium stage, and it will be on a large proscenium stage this year. So staging has changed. I no longer had the set that I had at Sac State, so I had to figure out a way to create a set. And I commissioned Stephanie Conrad, our marvelous scenic painter, and she painted six columns for me. She designed and painted six beautiful columns on muslin. And then I used everything from my home for the set, which I will use this time. So that changes the meaning. Everything from the set. There are large brass candle holders, icons, the fabrics, the statues. Everything I'm bringing is from the sacred sanctuary of my home to create that sacred sanctuary on the space. So it's changed in that way.
This is, I would say, the easiest adjective to go to is deep. This is a very deep story that is wrapped around ancient texts and music and dance. But there's part of it that is truly a bearing of your own soul. Sometimes there can be a window in time when you're in that space and feeling okay about being very open and vulnerable. How do you continue to be there in that place, in this production over the years?
What an incredible question. I believe in transparency. And so all of the original writings in the piece, which are mine, are my soul, opening my soul to others to be transparent. Because I believe if I can continue to open up the brokenness that has been in me to heal, it will help others heal. And so each time I'm on that space, I'm a different person. And this is only the second time I'm doing it as a solo piece. But I think I'm a different person from yesterday to today. And so by being present in the moment on that stage in front of that particular audience helps me to stay centered and focused and hold on to the message that I want to send out to the audience.
Let's listen to a bit of the show, which helps everybody understand what we're talking about. This is a clip that we're calling My Son. And I'll set it up by saying that you do not have children.
No, I do not.
And so there is a figurative son that you will refer to, but I think the rest of it is pretty self-explanatory. So here is Antonia Kokouras from Unveiling the Soul.
My son. Do I know him only through plays? Do I see him only in my friends' sons, my nephews, my student sons? But where is my son, of my blood and breath and heartbeat? My son. He never had a chance. He was chosen not to live, a marriage that was not to be. And I would never have a child out of marriage. I like to think that God used me in the lives of many others, so my fate was not to have children. Is it an excuse for the heartache I sometimes feel when I see parents standing proudly watching their children? I trust that God will give me my children in another form. Yes, he will.
What has come back to you from people who have seen the show in your gift of being so open, that piece, for example?
Oh, my. First of all, they ask me how I have dealt with, maybe it's the vacuum of not having children, and I answer it is nieces, nephews, godchildren, and students. And then they tell me that their sorrows of not having children, and they speak about it. And so in speaking about it, I believe it helps them heal a little bit. And we share, but they share many, many things about the entire show. They talk a lot about the courage to be transparent, and that each time I did share an original writing of transparency, it took them into their own place and allowed them to say, yes, I can share something deeper about myself, and maybe it will help others.
There is a very high form of love that is central to the play. If you would talk about that, and then we want to move into some of the old texts and writings that you use, because the show is intricate, and as I said, it speaks to people on different levels than maybe most productions that people would see.
Agape. Agape is the highest form of love. It's unconditional love. And the beauty of seeing people through the lens of agape really allows you to see them. And in seeing them, there is not that judgment, because you first learn to accept yourself, your complexities, those other parts of yourself that are difficult and strange. And through that lens of agape, then you can see others in that same way. And so I base the entire show on that lens of agape, and that you can transform, and you can have revelations, and you can heal, and you can forgive, and you can go through despair and trials and everything when you know that you are held in the arms of agape.
But I don't need to tell you that this is a rough world right now. There is a lot of judgment. There is a lot of meanness. And for someone to dig into a deep place, a place of pain, and be willing to bring that up and trust that there is an embrace of unconditional love out there that makes it safe to do that, I think is extremely challenging for you. And it's a message that you've given to young people over the year, to college students who are really trying to find their way. So what's your stepped back wisdom for the message that you're giving in your show, and then the context of the world and how hard it is to be that real?
My parents were immigrants. They came from Greece. They came to America to build a life. This magnificent country was built on immigrants. And I believe that whether it's immigrants, whether it's our students, whether it's our friends, there is a sense of the other in all of us. And if in this world we can embrace that other, truly embrace that other, this brokenness in this world will stop, because there should not be barriers or breaks between races, between creed, between men and women, between parties, political parties. We've got to come together. And so I continue to be the eternal optimist. And that optimism is what I want to tell students, to tell friends, to tell the world. Hold on to that optimism. We can embrace that other in others. But first, we must look inside and reflect and excavate that otherness in ourselves. How can you accept another unless you've accepted the other in yourself?
You are listening to Andania Kokouras, Sacramento State Theater Professor Emeritus. She will perform Unveiling the Soul at the Sacramento State Theater and Dance Department. It's a one-night-only engagement, June 15th at 8 o'clock. It is also a fundraiser. I understand proceeds from the performance will be donated to the Greek Orthodox Church of the Annunciation for a particular trip that's coming up, correct?
Yes.
That will be a mission trip to Kenya. And also the donations go to the Sac State Department of Theater and Dance. The adaptations of ancient and modern Greek literature, Byzantine hymns and chants, that's some of the work that brings you back to campus now as a guest artist, correct?
Yes, it does.
And there is a monologue that I'd like to share. I'm kind of walking a slow ramp up into it because to just hit play on it is pretty intense. Do you want to set up a little bit of this monologue that we're going to listen to?
Sure. I've been doing this agave monologue from the Bacchae for many, many years, back in 1980 when we brought Takis Mouzanidis to the campus to do the Bacchae. And doing that role changed my life, literally. And agave is the daughter of the king of Thebes, and her son is Pentheus. Dionysius comes to Thebes in order to claim his birthright, and he is rejected as the other. And so what happens is Dionysius puts a frenzied spell on all the women of Thebes, and they go out into the wilderness, and so does Agave and her sisters. And Pentheus dresses as a woman, goes into the wilderness, and wants to spy on what the women are doing. In this state of frenzied non-reality, Agave and her sisters see him as a wild lion, and Agave kills her own son with her own hands, rips him to pieces. And the monologue has three parts. The first part is she's addressing the city of Thebes and showing the head of Pentheus with great pride, and she's still in an altered state. Then her father brings her into reality. She sees the head in her hands and does not know how it got there. He tells her that she killed her own son. Mm-hmm. And then the last part is her lament, which I actually sang in the production, and her realization of what she has done.
So now let's listen to some of that monologue done by Andania Kokouras.
Now, I can see how everything has changed. I am in anguish now, tormented, who walked in triumph minutes past, exulting in my kill. And that prize I carried home with such pride was my own curse. Upon these hands I bear the curse of my son's blood. How can I, accursed with such a curse, hold him to my breast? Oh, God! What dirge can I sing that there might be a dirge for every broken limb?
And that is from Unveiling the Soul, again June 15th at 8 o'clock. I think you know that I'm taking a group of travelers to Greece this summer, and you actually were able to perform this show in Greece a few years ago. Will you tell me a bit about that?
Yes. Actually, the first time I performed it was in 2005 in Delphi, a place that I had always dreamed to perform it, with artists from all over the world, and including the Isadora Duncan dancers. Mm. And I also performed it in Latvia and in Poland. And then I performed it again in 2010 at the American College in Greece, and also for a private showcase of actors and directors. And so it was just an astonishing, extraordinary experience to perform in Delphi, where you could feel the ancestors and a great, great, great honor.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, the show goes on. What's next for you? What's on your schedule and your calendar?
Well, I'm hoping to tour with this piece if I get invitations to other universities or professional theaters. I have delivered several papers since my retirement, one in Paris and San Diego, and also in Vancouver. So I will continue my scholarly work. And I hope, as I said, to tour. I do privately coach. I hope to continue to go back to Sac State and offer this monologue each fall if they invite me again. And I am going to Greece this summer. So that is on my schedule. I'm going for a wedding on the island of Icaria, the place where people live to be 100 or over. Hmm. So maybe I'll just stay and live there to be 100.
A blue zone, as
they
say.
A blue zone it is. And then I'll, of course, travel to my area of Greece, which is Sparta.
Yeah. We had a lovely conversation back in 2015 at the time of this original staging of the show. I'm going to post a link because in 10 minutes, you really explained the backstory of your life and how, by some divine happenstance, you landed here in Sacramento from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and it became your home, and how life carries us. And it's really a beautiful story. And I think that it's so lovely how you've been able to go to Greece, which is not only family roots, but a place that you dreamed about, and in some ways make that a stopping point, but keep your home here.
Yes, absolutely. Sacramento really is home. I really have put down roots here. My Greek community, my students, it's home. But Greece, oh my, that's a different kind of home. My soul is Greece. And this may sound funny to people, but every single time I fly to Greece, and I've been there about 14 times now, I lean down and take a piece of the earth, the ground, the dirt, and put it in my mouth. Because that's how much I love Greece. I want to taste it. And it is that magnificent to me.
Well, I am going to take that spirit with me. I don't know how much dirt we might eat, but
please don't.
But I will capture all of that essence with love. Thank you so much. It's always a joy to have you here.
Thank you so much, Beth.
Andania Kokouras, again, her one-woman show, June 15th, 8 o'clock. We will post a link. And thank you. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're back with another show tomorrow.